Hej och välkomna till avsnitt 1217 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, Sveriges enda konservativa USA-podd med mig, Ronny Berggren, som kan stödjas på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0. Här följer en intervju gjord av min kollega John Gustafsson med Scott Lindsicum, en jurist specialiserad mot internationella handelsfrågor och skribent för den konservativa Trump-skeptiska The Dispatch. Scott Lindsicum är också forskare på den nyliberala tankesmedjan Cato Institute. I den här intervjun pratar han och John Gustafsson om Kinas framväxt och Trumps handelskrig, samt även om Brexit och om USAs invandringspolitik. Varmt välkomna.
Okay, Scott Lindsicum, welcome to the podcast.
No, thanks for having me.
So you're a senior fellow with the Cato Institute, and for those who don't know the Cato Institute, who are you guys?
So Cato is a libertarian think tank that's been around since the 1970s. And essentially we believe in free markets and free people. What is oftentimes referred to as fiscally conservative and socially liberal, but really it's kind of a classical liberal philosophy dating back to kind of to the founders and before that, and embodied in the Declaration of Independence.
Okay, so and for Swedish and for Swedish listeners, I just want to intercept here and say libertarian is nyliberal in Swedish, just so people don't get lost.
So you've been
very critical of the trade policy of Donald Trump. Yes, I know, I'm putting it mildly. But at the same time. As many would agree with you that, you know, on the basics about comparative advantage and free trade being economically positive, there's also a question of how do you tackle China's emerging status as a superpower. So how do you balance this, or how would you tackle China's rising power in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to start with what not to do, and that's, I think, the big problem. There's pretty universal agreement out there, particularly in Washington, but even among policymakers and pundits and wonks like me, that the China's economic rise and military adventurism and human rights violations raise concerns and present some pretty real challenges for both the United States and the world. But that's where the agreement stops, I think, because getting into kind of what not to do is we have just boatloads of economics and history and the rest that we can examine to see, well, what happens when we aggressively confront another sovereign power, particularly one with a very large economy and a very far away, I should say, in terms of kind of global regional influence. We know what happens in these cases when we try to confront them head on. We also know very well what happens when tariffs are applied indiscriminately, particularly in an era of global supply chains. And on the first point, we know that it is very, very difficult to use economic statecraft to change the behavior of a large sovereign nation, particularly when it is done unilaterally. The United States back in the 1980s tried this a lot, using tariffs and the rest and threats to change the behavior of much smaller nations, and was pretty unsuccessful, really only achieving a policy change about 20% of the time in the case of actions that were similar to what the Trump administration has done with China. And that was back when the United States was truly the heavyweight of the global economy. I mean, a real hegemon in terms of the ability to throw around its economic weight and to kind of bully nations into submission. It also was a time when supply chains had not proliferated like they have today. And that which provides China with both more options abroad in terms of export markets and in terms of imports, but also again creates a vulnerability for American manufacturers, whether invested abroad or that rely on imports to produce other things. And so we know very well that these kind of aggressive head-on threats don't work very well. Again, and then on the tariff side, we know that these tariffs tend to cause rather substantial economic pain for the United States and for American manufacturers, American farmers, and the rest. Farmers, especially through retaliation by the foreign government at issue. And that's exactly what happened with China. We really saw all of the things that have happened in the past have happened again. Now, what would I do? Well, I mean, I think that we also, from our history books, know what works better. And that is multilateralism, I think, first and foremost. And what I mean by that is the use of the World Trade Organization through formal dispute settlement and negotiation, but also the use of like-minded allies, whether it's the European Union or Japan or others, to create a coalition of the willing of sorts, to both pressure the Chinese, whether it's through the World Trade Organization or through sanctions for human rights issues or whatever, but also through liberalization, which is what the Trans-Pacific Partnership was trying to do, in the sense that we were going to lower barriers on other countries' imports to provide them with a safety valve of sorts and some security in the United States, and to deepen the economic integration between the U.S. economy and those economies. And then finally, you know, I mentioned sanctions. Look, there's a perfect role for targeted unilateral sanctions, again, for things like human rights issues, for foreign policy issues, for weapons and high tech, dual-use technologies, things that can be used as weapons. All of that makes perfect sense. But unfortunately, we're just simply not pursuing that right now. And I think that the end result is quite a mess.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You mentioned the European Union here, which actually brings us to my next question. Joe Biden has threatened that should the UK withdraw from the UK has a withdrawal agreement with the European Union.
Yeah.
And he has said that if they break that withdrawal agreement, if they endanger peace in Northern Ireland, he will refuse to negotiate a trade deal with the UK. Do you think this is reasonable, or should the US prioritize doing a trade deal with Britain?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, I think you know, it's really important to know that when politicians say stuff on the campaign trail, that doesn't mean they're going to pursue that policy in practice. So I don't think it's certain that that Biden will pursue that. But I also, you know, quite frankly, no offense to the folks in the UK, I don't really see a US-UK FTA as a priority for the United States. I mean, look, it'd be good. It'd be very helpful for the UK, given all of the tensions they're having with the EU. It would be a nice thing to have, but I don't think it's an economic or foreign policy priority. And again, I know that will upset some people who think it should be, but the fact is that trade between the United States and the UK is relatively free already. The two economies are quite similar in the sense that we have strengths in the same areas, be it, for example, financial services. And so there's not a lot of complementarity with and comparative advantage, so economic gains. And so it would be, I think it would be good, but it's not an imperative. And I contrast that dramatically with, again, something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where I think there really is a significant economic and geopolitical urgency to those deals, given China and given also the proximity of those economies to China. And that's a really big point because you know, the gravity model of trade, we call it, is that you tend to trade, countries tend to trade with their closest neighbors. And economies like Japan and others are inevitably going to be dragged into China's orbit. And an agreement like TPP, again, helps give them an alternative. And of course, TPP was intended to be a foundational agreement to have other countries join in. So it wasn't just going to be Malaysia and Vietnam and Japan and others, but it was also intended to include countries like Thailand to pull the Korea, which already has an FTA with the United States, into that agreement and others. And eventually, perhaps, even pressure China to adopt some of these rules on, for example, state-owned enterprises and other things. And I, you know, you just don't see a similar urgency in the UK FTA. Again, it would be good, but it lacks, I think, both the economic and geopolitical significance.
I suppose that what I would like, we're not yet in the debate, but I've just counted that given the relationship between the US and the UK. Now, if there's a trade deal that takes some time, I think that could be fine because, like you said, there's already a lot of trade, there's already a lot of similar standards and so on.
Right.
But if the US were to boycott the UK on the grounds of the UK, you know, not
right.
agreeing to what the EU says, that would destroy the US-UK
yeah.
relationship. It would be unforgivable, quite frankly.
Right. And I don't see that. I don't see any chance of that happening, quite frankly.
Yeah. So. So just moving on to the next topic. So a lot of the political debate pre-coronavirus, we should say, because now that's everything everyone's talking about.
Right.
But a lot of the pre-corona, a lot of the political debate was about immigration. Now, Defending Democracy Together, which is a group that you've also been involved with,
yep.
is pro-immigration. So.
Mm-hmm.
Why, as a conservative, should one support increasing legal immigration to the U.S.? What are the benefits?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think there are a handful. First is the economics. The fact is that the vast majority of Americans benefit from increased immigration. It's really not even close. The only area where there could possibly be any sort of adverse economic effects are going to be for Americans without a high school degree, which is a shrinking share of the population, and current immigrants that are low-skill immigrants. But even that research is pretty weak overall. And then again, when you look at the net economic benefits for the country as a whole, they are pretty massive. But there are also, I think, really substantial geopolitical benefits. You look, for example, at a situation like Hong Kong. We should be opening our borders to the Hong Kongers, in my opinion. This is a highly motivated, highly educated group that is, of course, increasingly under the thumb of a repressive Chinese regime, and using the United States labor market and the United States as a counterbalance is pretty awesome, I think. And of course, that goes for all sorts of other places. You know, it really is a fantastic way to exert American influence around the world. There also, though, is just a tremendous benefit beyond just simply having, you know, refugees or individuals like Hong Kongers come over. And that is that there is a lot of research that shows that past restrictions on high school immigration in the United States actually serves to benefit other countries, because what happens is multinational corporations that don't have access to global talent, they offshore that research and development to other countries. One of the countries they offshore to is China. And so what you see, again, in kind of when you think geopolitically, so not only do we get the benefit of all of that R&D here in the United States, but we also deny that same R&D, that same investment to potential adversaries like China. So there's a double whammy effect there. And then finally, you know, I think there's something quite American and wonderful about new cultures and the assimilation of those cultures into the American fabric. You know, it's a little bit cheesy, I think, but at the same time, it's real. You know, I think that America benefits from a rich cultural diversity, and I don't simply mean getting awesome food. There's all sorts of really cool benefits of that. And contrary, again, to the critics, individuals, immigrants tend to assimilate after about two generations. That's quite standard. There's been no degradation of that assimilation over the last century. And that is, I think, again, it's a real benefit for the country. So I don't see a lot of downside, quite frankly. In fact, I think it's one of those policies that has just a massive upside.
Yeah, that's interesting, because one of the things that I've reacted to as a European is that when American conservatives talk about immigration, they are talking as if they are in Europe, where the vast majority of immigration is asylum-based. And of course, asylum immigration does impose, especially for countries like Sweden, which have a massive welfare state, it imposes, quite frankly, a real serious cost. But in the U.S., when you talk about immigration, most immigration is workforce, labor immigrants, as you say, you know, people who would, you know, skilled immigrants and of course, those who are taking on work that is not that attractive to Americans right. In the first place. I think that's an important differentiation, because I see a lot of American Trumpists, and I feel like they think they're living in Sweden when they talk about immigrants.
And it's really odd, too, because, again, if you look at the research, you see that immigrants are not, contrary to some of the myths out there, immigrants are not net drains on American social services. That the studies show that generally immigrants are net contributors to the kind of tax base in the United States. And that, in fact, natives receive far more in terms of federal benefits than immigrants. And you know, I would note, and it's funny that since you and I are talking, we missed also one really important category of American immigrants, and that is students. And there are just massive benefits from having really being the center of intellectual gravity in the world for immigrant students, many of which come here and not only provide knowledge and not only pay full tuition most of the time, but also end up staying here, which again is great. We have the best and brightest who want to come here, who want to contribute, and that is all awesome. And unfortunately, again, in the Trump years, it's starting to go away. Not entirely, but it is starting to decrease, and that I think is a real problem.
You should really read my article on that subject. I think I may have sent it to you. It's about how the economics of academic freedom. So we've talked about much of the same things.
And in fact, there was a fantastic Wall Street Journal article just about, I don't know, 2 months ago, that when all of the hysteria around Chinese students was coming up, and there was a really great article about how universities were actually working with Chinese students to protect them from the Chinese government when it came to criticism of Hong Kong and other and the Uyghurs and the rest. And there really is a kind of wonderful relationship between most higher education and immigrant students. And it kind of saddens me to think that it might be going away.
Yeah. So just to move on to the next topic I want to talk about. So the U.S. deficit is set to be over $3 trillion this year. We don't have the final number, obviously. Very much an unthinkable number even just a few years ago. The trend was upwards trending even. It was upward sloping even before COVID. How would you? I know Cato are deficit hawks, and I lean towards that side myself. But how would you balance the need to bring down the deficit with the need for obviously businesses who are in lockdown or similar to get support? Like, how do we do this?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think you're going to find a lot of libertarians who were, well, let me put it this way, actually, let me revise that. I think you'd find a pretty even split among libertarians when it came to the need for fiscal stimulus and for government spending during the depths of the pandemic. So in March and April, I was actually fully on board with fiscal policy during that period. And my reasons were actually from a very libertarian perspective, and that is that the government, the federal and state governments, had essentially shut down people's livelihoods and had essentially banned them from working. And that was for, I think, well-intentioned reasons, again, to try to prevent the spread of the pandemic, to maintain hospital resources and the rest. But when you do that, you owe people just compensation, just as takings would be in the Constitution. And so I think that expansion of fiscal policy at that point, at least when it comes to direct payments to individuals, was pretty justified. Now, how do we get out of that? Well, the fact is that even with all of that pandemic spending, most of which is a one-off payment, the fact is that what really drives our fiscal imbalances here in the United States is our entitlements. And the fact is that until we figure out a way to get entitlements under control, and that is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and the rest, it really doesn't matter. That one-off hit doesn't matter that much. It really is much more about the long-term drivers of the debt in the United States, and that's all, again, entitlements. So what you have to do is figure out a way to reform it. Now, you know, there are some that say, oh, you can just, fiddle with the retirement age here or tweak a Medicare tax there. Now, of course, libertarians would not. I think that's a pretty foolish policy. The way that I've always put it is it's like buying new pants every time you gain 20 pounds, right? It doesn't actually solve the problem. It simply, it puts another Band-Aid over it, right? I think our approach is far more to create individualized and portable benefits for, individual retirement accounts, individual health savings accounts, and the rest, and to remove the burden, the fiscal burden from the state.
First of all, I agree with that. And I think with the one-time stimulus payments, there's a parallel that can be made to eminent domain, obviously, where if the state takes your property, the state has to compensate you at market rates. And you can make the same argument, which if the state takes your livelihood, it should compensate you at a market rate, so to speak. I also find it fascinating, when speaking of entitlements, that Sweden managed to do a social security reform before the U.S. within 25 years ago.
Honestly, we have a lot of, America's political debate over entitlements is utterly broken. And some of that is due to President Trump, who as a Republican, Republicans were supposed to be the ones campaigning on reforming entitlements. Of course, he abandoned all of that. But a lot of it, I think, goes back to the failed effort of the George W. Bush administration to reform Social Security, that he took such a political hit there that no one has really tried ever since. Paul Ryan, who was Speaker of the House, he kind of flirted with this, but in general, there hasn't been much effort. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like there's going to be much of an effort anytime soon. And given, again, the kind of – if you just look at the trajectory of just Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, you just look at the spending there, it's unsustainable unless you really dramatically raise taxes or reform those programs. And, unfortunately, nobody wants either. The Americans don't want their taxes raised. And Americans want all of those benefits. And those benefits, of course, pay out far more than Americans put in. So it's a perpetual deficit machine of sorts.
Yeah, that's one thing that's fascinating me with the U.S. is essentially trying to replicate a Nordic-style welfare state in some areas while being, far from Nordic tax rates. So I also find it interesting what you said about the deficit, that the problem is not the one-time payment. And I would agree overall. Yeah. But as a behavioral economist, and I did mention to you before this interview that, you know, I'm a behavioral economist, and I know Kate doesn't like those. But as a behavioral economist, I would like to point out that the big problem, as I see it, is that the reference point for what is considered a high deficit can change. $1 trillion was an extremely high deficit at one time. Now it's standard, essentially. People get used to the idea.
Yeah.
The numbers get too big. They don't mean much. They sort of stop. There's an adaptation that's very dangerous.
Yeah, and I get that. I would note, however, that people's enumeracy starts far below $1 trillion. And so, you know, I think that we're now so far into the stratosphere that I'm not sure how much, you know, the behavioral economic side of things really applies. But that's your area. I'll leave that to you. I think the more important thing, though, is that I think that I know other kind of free market libertarians have as well. We need to adapt our priors a bit on what is a truly problematic debt level, because as you'll probably recall, 15, 20 years ago, not even that much, there was real concern that the low rates and high spending were going to kind of create this inflationary spiral. And that just never happened. And what we realized is that the U.S. economy can take on more debt before we have any sort of inflation or other issues. Now, contrary to some out there, we of course don't think that this is sustainable ad infinitum, right? You can't do this forever. But it does appear that the threshold is much higher than assumed. Now, the key, of course, is that the debt isn't a problem until it is. And you never know when there is that tipping point, when people finally say, you know what, I'm not going to buy a U.S. debt anymore. And then you might have a problem. You know, interest rates go up and you have a mess. But we're not at that point quite yet. And we need to, I think, adjust a bit on what we consider to be an acceptable level.
Yeah. So final question, I ask this to everyone in the U.S. who might interview. It may take a while for the GOP brand to recover after Trump, assuming that he loses on Tuesday. We'll have to see about that. But what would you like to see in a 2024 candidate?
Well, I mean, I would hope that there would be some return to a legitimate free market policy. I'm not foolish. I don't think, you know, tomorrow we're going to wake up to Republicans praising unilateral free trade, right? But the Republican Party has gone so far towards the populist left on economics that it would be nice to see them revert back a bit to less anti-corporate populism and less industrial policy, subsidies, tariffs, and the rest, and back more towards kind of the mainstream middle. Is that a kind of Mitt Romney-esque approach that, you know, contrary to popular belief, Mitt was not the free marketer that some claim. He was actually quite anti-China and the rest. I don't know if that's what it'll look like, but the hope would be that Republicans embrace real free markets, not merely this kind of Trumpian mishmash of populism.
Okay, Scott Lindsaycombe, thank you very much for being on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Det var avsnitt 1217 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, Sveriges enda konservativa USA-podd som finns för att ge det perspektiv på USA som svensk media inte ger. Stöd gärna på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0 eller genom att via hemsidan stödja på PayPal, Patreon eller bankkonto. Det var allt för idag. Tack för att ni har lyssnat.
We'll be right back.